Celebrity or real person?
A real person.
Male or female?
Female.
Give me a second here. I'm usually...
Oh, come on. There are no real people anymore. We're all celebrities, or at least legends in our own blogs, Twitter feeds, and podcasts. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Berkley Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? It's cold. You know, it feels like, never mind Thanksgiving, we should be taking down Christmas decorations. It's so cold in much of the country, and some folks have snow, like in Buffalo. Believe it, 2+ feet? Ooh, glad I'm not shoveling out of that. Thanks for joining us today. We have so much to talk about in our Free Flow Pop Culture Convo. Inspiration to Action shout-out. And think about this question, talking about inspiration. What's more inspiring if you're a writer? Flat-out bad writing or great writing? Talk about that a bit later. Get you in the mix, too, if you're listening live on Tuesday, November 18th. It is still November, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, as everything is, because it's so darn cold. 347-857-4505. Twitter feed, Aurora says, getting busy already at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by Verizon Fios, rated number one for upload speeds. Also by PopNet, its new and improved arts, culture, conversation, online on the air, 24/7, the new improved PopNet. And by Kellogg's Frosted Mini Wheats, it's a win-win for your breakfast, nutritious and delicious. And the Oak Center for Lifelong Learning, it's never too late to embrace your dreams and live the life you've always wanted. Details at oakcenterlearning.org. Also, if you're looking for love this time of year, people around the holidays, never mind eHarmony and Match.com. They got nothing on the California penitentiary system. Have you heard? Convicted murderer lifer Charles Manson, playing Hugh Hefner at age 80 behind bars. He just got himself a marriage license to marry a 26-year-old. Wow. Speaking of crazy justice stories and then some, welcome back one of our fan faves. Patrick Moore joins us. You know him, the noted criminal investigator and the founder of All Things Crime blog. He's also joined us, novelist. He's in the fray now with his debut, Cicero's Dead. That is really exciting news. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the show. We're having a little trouble. See, things are slow in the system, Trudy, but it's not your fault. We'll get Patrick on in a minute. We're having trouble getting his microphone going. I suspected we'd have some issues, and we do. We're waiting on, we should mention the whole Ferguson situation. The governor has declared a state of emergency in preparation for all this. It's fraught with tension down there. And what will happen when the grand jury comes back with their decision? Maybe today. They've been talking about it since last week, so there's obviously some wrangling going on whether or not they will indict police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. I think we have Patrick now. Hey, Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here. Glad to be here.
A pleasure. Hey, congrats again on the book. We'll talk a little bit about that later. What exciting news. I didn't know you were a budding novelist while we were talking all those times before, so I'm excited for you. Very exciting. Thank you.
Oh, I've been hacking. I've been hacking away in the computer for a long time.
Yeah, I know. And that's happened sometimes. Good for you, though. We'll talk. Let's get down to a little bit of business. What do you know, the Ferguson situation, as we mentioned right before you came on, they're braced for the decision, but it hasn't come down yet. What do you have any new revelations on what's happening down there?
I don't have any revelations, but I know the governor, Jay Nixon, has declared a state of emergency. What I'm struck by is this strikes me as an extreme case where the media, in this case to its discredit, is really drumming up trouble and is doing everything it can to drum up trouble. There's undoubtedly, and you know, I suspect that Darren Wilson is not going to be indicted. I could be wrong. And it's going to be a bad situation. Blood probably will spill. And the media is clearly contributing to this. It's one thing when the media creates a media circus around a high-profile trial, high-profile case like the Jody Arias case. But, you know, no one there, you know, it may affect the outcome of the case. But beyond that, it doesn't really hurt anyone. Whereas in a case like Ferguson, where the media is doing everything they can to drum up interest in, it's not like voices are calling out for calm and for people to be reasonable. Rather, they, you know, everyone seems to like the idea that, you know, blood may spill. And, you know, and I find that upsetting because it's, you know, it, you know, the media is very important and it's a misuse of its power, I would say.
Yeah. It it's interesting that you say that. I also agree that the people that are calling for calm seem to be Michael Brown's family, their lawyers. I mean, people, they're saying the right things and hitting the right notes, but they don't seem to be absorbing it in terms of the crowd. I'm not sure if it's the mainstream media or if it's just certain pockets of people who have gone down there. I mean, I know there have been reports in the last couple of days. I saw that Anonymous and Hacktivists, these are some groups that were involved in the Occupy movements, were threatening to cause trouble, and not only in Ferguson but other cities, sort of to drum up, you know, basically, as you said, fan the flames and really cause problems. I mean, are you saying that, you're suggesting that the presence of the media being there and covering it is in and of itself causing some of this furor, or no? I don't know. I'm not sure where I stand on that.
I think it's a complex situation. I think because in our world of instant communication, you know, happens so fast that it's like everyone is kind of ahead of the game. Everyone is anticipating what will happen with preconceptions as far as what's going to happen.
Yes.
So that things in a sense, perhaps don't develop naturally. I'm reminded this is perhaps not the best analogy, but one of my children who's in college now just had to write a paper for an English class. And the topic was, with computer technology, the way that it actually is written by an MIT professor, professor of psych at MIT, and her thesis was that computer technology has drastically affected not just the way we spend our time, but the way we think, and it's resulted in a kind of superficiality that wasn't formerly there. She uses the example of the PowerPoint presentation where you have a visually striking presentation that hits the key points, hits the bullet points, and that's basically it. You don't go any deeper. And I think that's what tends to happen, you know, in the media in some cases, you know, now in our society. I mean, you know, to me, and I'll just very briefly, you know, outline, you know, my thoughts on Ferguson. I've chosen not to cover it on All Things Crime Blog because I don't have all the answers and I don't have all the information. But I do think two things which I think are important. Number one, I think obviously Darren Wilson didn't have to shoot this kid, Michael Brown. I think it was entirely unnecessary. I often feel that too many of our law enforcement officers, are far too eager to shoot people in, you know, cold blood on our streets. So I do think that, but I also think something else, and this is an unpopular opinion, I'm sure, but, you know, Michael Brown, there seems to be little doubt that he did have some kind of an altercation with the police officer, Darren Wilson. And, you know, and my point is that at his age, he was 18 years old, I believe, or whatever he was, he should have known better. In other words, when the cops stop you for whatever reason, your instinct for self-preservation should take over, and you should immediately become aware that, you just treat the officer with respect, whether he deserves it or not. If you don't, God knows what the officer is going to do, and in this case, it cost Michael Smith his life. And if he had treated that officer with respect, once again, whether he deserved it or not, this very likely would not have happened. He would still be alive. And, I've taught, my kids, you know, we live in a dangerous and zero-tolerance society, and I teach them to be careful. That is, and I often explain to, you know, one of my daughters, you know, I got away with a lot of stuff when I was a young man. That was, 45 years ago when I was an adolescent teenager. And it's just, we live in a different world now. You just have to be way more careful than you did back then. And it's a lesson that I don't, you know, and kids naturally believe they know everything and don't listen to adults and so on and so forth. I mean, if I were an educator, let's say I was an administrator in high school, I would do everything I can to have a class for the kids in which they're taught about, you know, domestic violence, how to report it, how to avoid it, that it's a real thing in our society. I would also talk about how, you know, just the need to be careful. you want to survive your teenage years, so you go on to grow up and raise a family and all that. So that's really what I have to say on that. I think the shooting was probably entirely unnecessary. I don't think Darren Wilson will be indicted, and I think it's tragic that either no one ever taught Michael Smith the lesson
Michael Brown.
He didn't listen to the lesson that, you know, just, you know, treat law enforcement with kid gloves. They are
You say that about talking to your kids, because very often I think, I don't know if we talked about it particularly, I know we did talk about Zimmerman when you've been on before, but I know I had a whole discussion about Zimmerman and race with several people, and the black people who were on the panel would say that, you know, the truth is that black parents normally have a different sort of discussion, particularly with their sons, about dealing with police and going out into the world, because they are afraid of that. So I'm surprised if that discussion wasn't had between Michael Brown and his parents, who seem to be very lovely people and involved with him. And, of course, he was described all along initially as a gentle giant. Then they showed that video. They dribbed and drabbed all this stuff out into the media with him having the altercation at the convenience store where he stole the cigars and pushed a clerk and all that. So that was already a signal that they were trying to set off, that he's not what people were saying about him, that he really is a bad kid. But stealing cigars and getting into kind of a dust-up in a store doesn't necessarily mean you should be shot to death. So I agree. Something happened. Obviously something happened at the car. What's interesting about it, and I respect what you just said, and I'm kind of on the same page with you when you said we're not covering it on All Things Crime Blog, because we don't have all the facts. The problem with the way we report and discuss things, and we're all kind of guilty of it as we're discussing it in real time while it's happening, is things are unfolding. The story unfolds. Just like it would in a book, even if it's a fictional book, you don't know how it's going to go, and people get their narrative. They get so stuck on what the narrative is, either side. It's not whether you're on the police side or the Michael Brown side or whoever. Very few people, if you notice, when you talk about these hot cases, are letting the thing unfold as it happens, which is why I kind of think it would be a good thing if Wilson was indicted, just so we could see it play out in a court of law out in the open. The thing with the grand jury is it's behind closed doors. We don't know exactly what's going on. We don't know exactly what's presented. You get dribs and drabs. And I think the transparency of an actual trial would help sort the story out and see what happened and really if this guy is culpable. I kind of tend to agree that whatever happened at the car, if he did lunge into the car and he was out of control, maybe he was high, whatever it was, he was already out of the car, though, and away from the car when Officer Wilson shot him. And that's where Wilson, to me, has a problem.
Exactly. And because of that, based on what I know, and what I know is very incomplete, I do feel that Wilson probably should be indicted. I like your point. Because, I mean, it seems clear to me that whatever Michael Brown did initially, and I think he made a big mistake initially, nonetheless, it appears that it was entirely unnecessary for him to be shot and killed. At my job in criminal defense here in Los Angeles, we work on wrongful death civil cases all the time, where cops shoot and kill people when they undoubtedly don't need to. In fact, we're working on one right now. It's a brand new case we're working on. And so this issue of the cops shooting and killing people for, you know, no good reason, it happens all too often in our society, and it's an appalling reality. And, it does happen, and chances are Michael Brown certainly did not need to be shot and killed.
It's interesting, what stories, because as you said, it happens not every day, but it does happen, and a lot of these stories don't get as much coverage. There was a story, a case in New York, close to where I am, shortly before the Ferguson incident, with this guy, Eric Garner. I don't know if you're familiar with that case, where he was this guy who was, I guess, a local, I don't know if you want to say menace, but he was a local character on Staten Island who would sell these, single cigarettes, which is a violation. It's not even a crime, I don't think. It's not even a misdemeanor in New York City. And police, I guess, had harassed him or told him to go away several times, and they got into some kind of an altercation. He wound up dying in what appears to be a chokehold by the police. That story kind of came and went. It's still on the back burner. They still haven't charged the cops, which surprises me. But as soon as Ferguson took off, that story, which had a little bit of national attention, but not as much, kind of got backburnered, and we don't hear about it anymore. So it's always intriguing what stories seem to catch the media's attention and people stick with it while there's so many other, you know, even when you talk about the Arias case, there's so many people that get murdered, there's so many all these cases, but for one reason or another, something strikes a chord and the media takes off, and then once it's taken off, it, you know, sort of takes on a life of its own, which is always kind of a fascinating aspect to it. But certainly, talking about these things before we know what's what, I think may be problematic. So I kind of respect what you did about saying we're not really covering it because I don't have the facts. You know, as I'm talking about with you, but we're getting ready for the decision. I'm wondering what I'm hoping that calm will prevail, but I suspect you're right. It's not going to be a good scene if he doesn't get indicted. And you shouldn't indict somebody just to avoid a scene, by the way. I'm not saying that the grand jury should be have pressure.
Of course. And, you know, it's a complex situation. And what you say there is very interesting. Why do some cases take off and become extremely present, omnipresent in the public eye, and others do not? I was aware of that Eric Garner case where I think he was a really big guy who was choked, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was a chokehold, I think.
And I was aware of that case, and you're right, it's kind of been backburnered, and the Ferguson case has taken over. And, you know, why certain cases take off and others do not, I mean, it's very hard to say. I face it all the time on the crime blog when I, you know, said, well, what stories will I run? And as time passes, I get a pretty good sense, well, okay, this, people will be interested in this one. People will not be interested in that one. And because I, you know, admittedly, I'm somewhat, you know, trying to get views, have people read the stories, I have a tendency on, you know, some days I run a story merely because I know that people will, or I'm pretty sure people will read it. On the other hand, on other days I run stories knowing very well that not nearly as many people are going to read it just because I think it's an important story that I should run. So I kind of vacillate and go both ways on that. But it's just very interesting. You know, it would be the same with books. Why are some books wildly successful where other books of equal or higher quality are not? It's just very hard to fathom public taste. It's a weird phenomenon. And then you add the media and the role they play in it, and it becomes even more convoluted and difficult to unpack.
Right. Well, you should just put out the story and see what happens, because you never know. Something might take off just because of your story, too, if you think it's an important case. That's what I would recommend to you. You know, put out something that you think this is an important story. I want people to know about it. And if only a handful of people care, so be it. But maybe you'll gin up more interest for it if it really is an important story. So that's an intriguing thing. Speaking of stories that have taken off, let's shift gears a little bit while we're still waiting for that verdict to come down from the grand jury in Ferguson. Bill Cosby back in the news, and not in a good way. These, I guess, decades-old rape allegations are haunting him once again. The timeline is a little murky for me, but I kind of figured it out what happened, at least from what little I've seen. Now, of course, Bill Cosby, the venerable icon, apparently, and I knew there was a suit years ago with somebody coming in, and they kind of hushed it up, and they paid off this woman, which never looks great, although some people will say celebrities pay off a lot of times with nuisance suits, they just don't want to deal with it. But, of course, to the public, it looks like, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. If you're paying off somebody, there must be a problem. But it has resurfaced that over the years, and women are coming out of the woodwork. So either you have a lot of women on a bandwagon who are going after this guy who's an icon, who is now 77, I believe, or he's done a lot of this bad stuff over the years, and it's been hushed up because he was so powerful, as this woman, Barbara Bowman, who came out with her op-ed in the Washington Post. I guess a lot of this got stirred up because there was a comedian who mentioned him as a rapist in a routine, got ginned up again, and he was on NPR on Saturday, and he just went literally radio silent when Scott Simon brought up the allegations and just sat there. He will not respond to it. His lawyer set out a statement saying that they're unfounded, they're decades-old, discredited allegations, and Mr. Cosby will not mention it anymore. But he has canceled some appearances, including one on the David Letterman's late-night show. And we'll see. He's got a sitcom in the works, another sitcom for NBC, if that's going to take over. So what's your view on this, and what a sad story it is either way?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. It is a sad story either way. You know, clearly, I have absolutely no idea whether or not Bill Cosby is guilty of these allegations. Some would say where there's smoke, there's fire. There have been quite a few of the allegations. And, you know, I really don't know I really don't know what to think. Once again, I have a couple of opinions that are very possibly unpopular opinions. And once again, it gets back to, you know, the fact that young people, and I was exactly the same way, tragically or unfortunately, we often just don't have very good sense. In other words, let's take Barbara Bowman, who, I mean, Bill Cosby may very well have drugged her and raped her. I don't know. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. But she put herself in a very vulnerable position. It's no different than what the woman, I can't remember her name, who Roman Polanski allegedly raped when she was 14 years old.
I was going to say she wasn't a woman; she was a girl. Yeah, then yeah.
She was a girl at that point, right? And of course, that story has resurfaced. So Barbara Bowman, she put herself in a very vulnerable position. I've seen over and over again, and this is not to blame her in any way. It's just the reality. I've seen over and over again as I've gotten older and hopefully a little bit wiser, is that important people in the public eye, perhaps more often than not, have feet of clay. Does that mean that Bill Cosby has feet of clay? I don't know. But what it certainly means is that our important public figures, you know, I'm basically, you know, pretty skeptical about, you know, most or all of them. And I am kind of a cynic. And, I'm never surprised when a celebrity figure or a person in the public eye, you know, falls from grace. Because, you know, and that actually gets to, it's something I've been toying with, which I call my psychopathic great man history syndrome. and it's the idea that, I've done a little research on it, a little perfunctory research. And, like, for example, the really strong and successful presidents, typically they rate very high on the psychopathology scale, which has been developed. I mean, there's several psychopathology scales. But what that means is these guys are invulnerable to criticism. That is, that's why they're able to move forward and act in a forthright and self-confident manner, because they're simply not threatened by criticism. I suspect if we were to take President Obama, who of course has, you know, has been attacked from both sides, but you know, also from his original liberal/progressive constituency, I suspect Obama rates very low on the psychopathology scale. That is, he doesn't have enough of the psychopath in him. As such,
he's not invulnerable
to criticism, and so he's not that larger-than-life, super-powerful figure that, you know, a politician probably needs to be successful. So, that's an area that hasn't been, perhaps explored enough. Another good example, not in politics, but, Bill Gates, the great Bill Gates, the man who wants to reduce the population of the world by 2.7 billion people, is apparently ranks very high in the psychopathology scale. And so once again, he has complete confidence, courage of his convictions, and he, you know, moves bravely forward. I know I got a little bit off the topic here, but my original point was that, you know, we expect the people who are in the media eye, in the public eye, to, you know, live up to be the positive figures we like to view them as. And so we're always shocked when they're not. But, you know, the point is that, you know, very often, you know, they're not. That's simply the reality.
Well, it's interesting because before the psychopathology scale, we would have the, Oedipus and the tragic flaw theory. You know, everybody has a tragic flaw. Like, you know, Bill Clinton, the tragic flaw was his libido and all those kinds of things. So whether it plays into...
Yeah, that's a great point. And Clinton is, you know, he's relatively high in the psychopathology scale. I think they refer to him as this Teflon man now and then. Because he was not threatened by, you know, criticism.
Yeah. Well, I guess.
That's a very good point you make about, you know, like the fatal flaw. And obviously, you know, with a lot of guys, you know, our fatal flaw probably is we're, you know, we're vulnerable to being attracted to women, females, girls, et cetera, perhaps, you know, inappropriately. And, and as we grow up and mature, it's very important that, you know, we need to learn to, you know, control that that inclination or drive. Did Bill Cosby learn to control it? I have no idea. I do know.
It's interesting. Of course, he did admit to affairs, because he did have, some years back, there was a woman, I forget her name now, Autumn something, I think, who came forward, who turned out to be his illegitimate daughter that he had with an out-of-wedlock affair. But there's a big difference between having an affair with someone and, you know, he stayed married to the same woman. She forgave him for all of that, and, all, you know, that's their business, and actually molesting and raping people. That's a whole other issue. And, you know, I have no idea whether it's true or not. Some people are more shocked than others, at least I am. Like when Phil Spector, he wound up killing that woman, Lana Clarkson, and all his craziness came out as his trials, because it was a deadlock jury in the first one. I don't know that I didn't know about it, but he was kind of a weird guy, so it wasn't so shocking that he was into this weird gunplay, you know. But Bill Cosby really has this very venerable reputation. Dr. Cosby, he has a doctorate from UMass. He's an educator as well as an actor, and that the Cosby Show was certainly a groundbreaking, iconic show that broke through a lot of racial barriers, et cetera, and such a cultural force. So that maybe this stuff was buzzing under the radar for a long time, and of course now he's in his upper 70s, and he's in this middle of this social media matrix, as you pointed out. Everybody's talking, everybody has a blog, everybody has a Twitter feed, everybody has a big mouth on Facebook, whatever it is. So everybody has an opinion, and everybody's spreading all this stuff, where, you know, 20, even 10 years ago, you might be able to keep things under wraps that you really can't now. So he's in the middle of all that, too. So who knows, you know?
And that's a very good point you make. It's because Bill Cosby was always thought of as Mr. Clean. He has an affair out of wedlock. Well, that's, as you say, it's completely different than the rape allegations. And the affair out of wedlock, is not that unusual, but the rape allegations are very serious. And I would say one thing, I had one thought on this, really my final thought on Cosby, is that, if he is guilty of these allegations, and because the statute of limitations has apparently expired, though I'm not sure, I think in some sex cases, statute of limitations never expires, so I'm not certain how that works. But, let's assume for the minute that he is guilty. I recall, and I'm not saying he is, but just suppose, I recall, it was probably about 10 years ago, Bill Cosby took the entire underprivileged black community in America to task for talking Ebonics, not doing what he felt they should do to pull themselves, up by their bootstraps, so to speak, and make more of their lives. And his criticism was quite scathing. And I was very aware of that at the time. I didn't have a strong opinion on it, whether he was right or wrong, because once again, it's a very complex situation, and so I, hesitate to make these broad generalizations, even though I am guilty of them sometimes. But, let's say Cosby is guilty. Well, if so, the man's an extreme hypocrite to take on the entire underprivileged, class of black Americans. While on the other hand, if he's not guilty, well, then it's just, it's of the sexual allegations, it's just his opinion, and it's, as valid as any other opinion.
I know, but the problem is with these allegations now, they're out there, and you can't really get rid of them. There are certain allegations, particularly, of sexual nature, or somebody suspected of murder. I mean, look at Casey Anthony, she got off, but people really still believe she killed her baby. I mean, there's certain things that you really can't shake off, so they're out there now. And if he is innocent, that's a real tragedy too, because you're taking someone's reputation and pretty much decimating it. But you have to wonder, what's in it for these women? Why are they doing it? Why would they come out of the woodwork now? Are they hoping for a bunch of civil suits? I mean, I don't know. The Barbara Bowman I saw on CNN last weekend, And she says she's not suing anybody. She's not looking for money. She just wants the story out there, and she wants to prevent other people from being affected. Well, apparently there have been 13 other women that came out. So it just seems like, you know, they're coming out of the woodwork, and what would be their motivation? Again, I'm not saying he is guilty, but what would be the motivation if he's not? Is it just joining on the bandwagon, people looking for 15 minutes of exposure? Are they looking to sue? I mean, you have to wonder all these things. But once it's out there, it's out there. I mean, look, I know you're not as familiar with this case. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it. But the case of Stephen Collins, the, you know, actor who was very popular on, what was it, Seventh Heaven, as the minister, he apparently, although he hasn't, also someone who hasn't said anything, but he immediately quit his post that he was in the Screen Actors Guild. He quit that post. He supposedly, during a, of all things, a couple therapy session, confessed to molesting a child of a friend of the couple's, he and his estranged wife. Somehow the tape has circulated. The wife denies it. The therapist, certainly, I'm sure, denying it, because he or she is going to be on the ropes for, at the very minimum, sanctions. As a, you know, therapy, you can't release clients' information, obviously. But it sounds like it's his voice. They had it all over all the tabloid shows, of admitting that he molested an underage girl, at least one, and there were some allegations at the time in New York. They're still, I guess, it's under investigation now, because the statute of limitations, as you mentioned, for rape is not, I think it's, there isn't one in New York anyway. And I think he also did it in L.A.,
I think,
but I don't know.
I think it varies from
state
to state.
I don't know if the California one, one or the other, there's still, it's still a possibility, the other state it's not. But he apparently confessed to doing this, and, you know, if he isn't him and it's a ginned-up tape, and of course, the fact that he didn't come out and vehemently deny it makes people believe it's true. I mean, if you, you know, on Cosby's end, he's not going to give any credence to these allegations, so his lawyer says, by discussing it, but some people will say, you know, if you really didn't do it, if it was me and somebody accused me of something, I'd be out there saying, hey, wait a minute, I did not do this. And certainly when it comes to something so egregious as rape, and particularly child molestation in the case of Stephen Collins, not to come out and face it, you kind of give the fact that maybe this did happen. It's still awful. The other side of that story, in Collins' case, it's horrible that someone outed him like that through a therapy session. That's another whole story that goes back to, like, the Donald Sterling case with the tapes that were released. He said something horrible, but was it right that his right to free speech was impinged upon? You know, that's a whole other story. But
in the case of Donald Sterling too, it's just like he's making obnoxious comments at worst. It seems to me it was
blown
all out of proportion.
Yeah, and it wasn't illegal.
Every time you make an obnoxious statement in private, if it's broadcast to the world, we would all be under attack. At least
exactly. It's funny. Well, it's like that's the Donald Sterling case is like analogous to when Imus made that stupid joke, and I laughed at the time because he made it once. It was an off the cuff, idiotic comment. I'm not condoning the comment, but he made it once. It was idiotic. Al Sharpton, who was one of his biggest critics, repeated it I don't know how many times. I'm like, Al, you keep saying it. But he said it once, you know. So who's worse, you know, the guy who keeps repeating it or the guy who said it once and, you know, and took the heat for it? So, yeah, obnoxious comments. And that was also under media scrutiny. Imus was a guy who had been making all kinds of crazy and obnoxious comments for years, but because you now have all these media watch sites and everybody's watching everything everybody says, your exposure level is, especially if you're a high-profile personality, is so much higher than it ever was. And for people who've been in the trenches for so many years, they were used to not forgetting away with stuff, I guess, you know, in that way. But those weren't illegal comments. You know, obnoxious comments could get you in trouble, and there could be consequences in terms of your career, as Imus and Paula Deen found out. But it's not the same as committing a crime. But with this taint of these allegations go ahead.
Although I'm not a big fan of politicians in general, I do tend to feel sorry for them or bad for them when they, you know, pop off and, you know, make some statement, and it's like people in the public eye are held to a different standard than private citizens, and I'm not sure if that's altogether fair, as they still, I mean, they are just human beings, they have flaws, we all do, and, you know, they say something and it, you know, ruins careers, causes, you know, shame and embarrassment to the family. There's all sorts of flack and fallout. So the idea that private speech has become, in so many instances, public speech would seem to me to be a real issue of our modern, modern, like, media, you know, saturated world in which.
Oh, because everybody has a cell phone. Everybody can record a conversation or take a picture. So that's the thing, or a video, you know, with the technology that we have today. But it's, you know, there's also the other side of it. You know, it's two-sided because you have the idea that they're under so much scrutiny. On the other hand, very often there's a sense of entitlement in the celebrity world where people think they can do whatever they want and get away with everything. I mean, if you take a look at the Real Housewives of New Jersey, for example, the Giudicis, who are on their way to the big house, they pretty much expected to, well, they were committing crimes. They were committing fraud way before they got in the show, but they didn't. Nobody knew who they were. They got in the show and they started living large, and then the IRS came to town and was looking into their activities, and other creditors came out of the woodwork, and they still live large. They still filed for a fraudulent bankruptcy even though they had all kinds of money, and now they're both going to jail. But I think they were shocked, particularly Teresa was shocked that she got a prison time. She assumed she was going to get probation. Is there the sense of entitlement that some people have who are celebrities, or what I like to call the reality people, the faux celebrities? What's your take on that?
Well, I think, for one thing, I'm kind of amused by it because it's my unfortunate fate on my job. I have to mostly handle fraud cases. And so in researching just slightly, you know, what the Teresa and what is the husband's name? Is it Joe?
Joe, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the fraud, it's such like garden variety, basic moronic fraud. I mean, we do these cases all the time where our clients do things exactly like this. They make false statements on applications. They, mm-hmm. They fudge figures. I mean, it's just basic. You know, this is not sophisticated fraud. You know, this is hardly like, you know, Bernie Madoff or someone. This is like low-level garden variety moronic fraud that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Americans do all the time. And I don't know what the percentages are, but they get caught all the time. If they didn't get caught all the time, I wouldn't be representing them all of the time. And I'm in my 12th year now of doing this, and you reach a point, you say, oh my God, not another. You know, why did you do this? How did you think you were going to get away with this? Are you truly a moron, or
clearly you haven't watched the show. You haven't watched the show, Patrick. If you're going to ask that question.
Yeah, well. Yeah, well, I mean, it's bad enough. My daughter tends to watch that Kardashian show, which, you know, my poor wife, oh my God, she pounds herself in the forehead and thinks it's the end of the world. And I just say, oh, it's, you know, not to worry. It's just a phase. And I did wonder. I wondered about exactly like that. You know, I got to, you know, catch an episode of this show to see what's going on. I did read something that Teresa and one of her friends is saying that, you know, Teresa is doing everything in her power. You know, she's keeping up her appearance. She's making sure her hair and nails and general accoutrements are all, you know, still perfectly right up to the scale that, you know, she tries to keep them at. And, you know, she's a brave woman she's going to do fine. Meanwhile, I think she's going to Danbury, which I'm not mistaken. I think that's where Martha Stewart went.
No. Martha Stewart didn't. No, Martha Stewart didn't go to Danbury. Martha Stewart wanted to go to Danbury because her mother was still. She wound up going to Alderson, which they call Camp Cupcake. It's supposedly the best one, but it was farther away. And Martha Stewart, I guess, didn't go because Danbury, according to if you read the Piper Kerman book Orange Is the New Black, that's where she went to prison. And she says that Danbury is such a dump, they didn't want Martha Stewart to be there. But Teresa, I think, is going to Danbury, although there's some question marks about it, because Danbury is being reconverted. Originally, it was a male prison, then it became a female prison camp, low, you know, medium and low security. Now they're reconverting it back to a male facility, so they only have a limited number of female prisoners. So we'll see if she gets there. Leona Helmsley did go to Danbury, by the way, back in
I remember now. Martha Stewart went and did Alderson. I guess that was that in West Virginia?
Yeah, West Virginia, right.
Yeah, I remember.
I guess that's supposed to be the nicest one. Yeah, good.
We had an associate working on getting her, Martha Stewart, designated, and I remember that. That was a good case for us because we got to charge a pretty high hourly rate, and I remember that she went there. So I was confused on that. That was my bad. You know, an interesting thing for, listeners in general is that when we talk about minimal or low security federal prisons, the generally speaking, according to, you know, some reports, the female minimal and low security prisons are considered to be, you know, worst places to do your time than the male minimal and low security places. In other words, it can get a little nasty in the female low security prisons, apparently. But once again, that's just, you know, that's hearsay evidence. You know, I haven't been in one, so.
Yeah,
you know,
me neither.
I don't know
what wouldn't want to go. I mean, that's why it's always funny when people say, it's going to be like a country club. I'm like, well, it's still prison. I still wouldn't want to go there. I mean, I don't know why people think it's no big deal. It's still, I'm sure, a scary proposition for her, but I do think they were facing like 50 years. She only got 15 months, and he got, I think, 41 months or whatever he got. And the judge
right.
was kind
of
enough to let them.
They wouldn't really, and that's kind of a misconception. They say she was facing 50 years. Well, she was facing 50 years probably based on statutory maximums added up.
Yes.
Right. And with very few exceptions, nobody ever gets, you know, anywhere even close to that. The fraud they did was, you know, it was a basic, you know, it was kind of an ordinary sized fraud, and they got kind of ordinary, you know, sentences.
But the thing was, they took a plea deal because they had a lot. It was ordinary fraud, but there were a lot of charges. That's the thing. That's why they took the plea deal. But even after the plea deal, she was complaining that she didn't realize that she was going to go to prison when she agreed to it. You know, and that was kind of curious and slightly amusing at the same time. But
that's one of the interesting thing about people facing charges. And of course, I see this all the time because I'm representing them. Some people really approach the position they're in a, you know, in a courageous and a very forthright fashion. They accept responsibility. Okay, I did screw up. Without a doubt, I screwed up. I shouldn't have done this. I wish I hadn't. However, I've done it, and I'm going to, you know, take this like a man or take this like a woman. But then you have the probably two-thirds of the defendants just, you know, whine all the way to the big house. The amount of whining that defendants are capable of is just amazing. It sounds like Teresa is one of these, you know, one of these whiners.
Well, she's trying to straddle both because she's saying that she wants to be a better person, but then they're of the school of, but we're blaming it on the accountants and the lawyers, and we just did what people told us, and there's no way the banks told them to fill out the form incorrectly. There's no way the lawyers and the accountants signed off on them committing fraud. They can only file...
I would tentatively disagree with that, as, you know, banks tell, you know, individuals to fill out forms incorrectly all the time. It's standard procedure on loan applications. It can be something as simple as, you know, do you drive a late model Lexus, or do you drive a, you know, 1996 Toyota Corolla? And they'll say, well, you put the more expensive car so that the loan goes through. So
right.
Banks are
that may be true, but I don't think anybody told them to gin up phony W-2 forms. I mean, I'm saying there's extensive that.
Oh.
I mean, I know that's how we got into the housing bubble when people were taking out loans, people who are underwater because they really couldn't have afforded things. Yeah, they fudged things a little bit, but we're talking really flat-out fraud that they did. I mean, I don't know. I don't, as far as I know, I've never heard of anybody saying, well, give me some fake information that you actually have income that you don't have. I mean, that's extreme.
I've done probably a dozen or more real estate fraud cases. And the way it's always described to me, and once again, this is just hearsay, you have loan agents, and loan agents are the ones who are putting the loan together. And then the loan has to go to the bank or whoever the lender is for underwriting, and admittedly this is hearsay, and this was in the day of the subprimes, but from everything I've heard, it was standard practice for representatives of the banks to come to loan offices, mortgage companies, which were, you know, the mortgage companies that were pushing a lot of loans through and getting a lot of them done. You know, they would come in and they would bring lunch and they would wine and dine them, and they would tell them exactly what was necessary to get the loans to go through. Were they telling them to make, you know, false statements on the loans? Not necessarily, but it was certainly a wink, wink, nod, nod kind of thing where, you know, everybody was more or less in on that together, and it goes right up, you know, right up to the level of the, you know, agents at the banks. And this is whining on the part of my clients that is not unreasonable in the sense of saying, well, how come they're singling me out, the little guy? How come I'm the one who's going to prison for this when the big guys were all involved in this? It went right up to the top. And, you know, and that's a valid complaint because, you know, it did go right up to the top. And it will go right up to the top again. Because as I always, you know, and when I'm in a compassionate mood with my clients, you know, I mean, here's what I always say. I say, okay, well, yeah, you broke the law. You committed fraud. You know, you shouldn't have done this. This is, you know, bad stuff. But, you know, you're just a small-time criminal compared to the big-time criminals who are actually running the show. And so that's a, you know, a whole other level. You know, it's like the too-big-to-fail syndrome.
Right. Well, I mean, the argument also could be, you could say that why should people go to jail for these things? And if that's, you know, there are days when I feel that way too. Just make them pay their fines. It's like when people don't pay their taxes, so they, you know, like Richard Hatch, and who, of course, then he came out and did it again. Right. So then my sympathy was gone. Just make them pay the fine and make them pay them, you know, pay back up the penalty at a higher level. But when if you keep doing it, that's not a good thing. But if you're going to do that, then you have to let everybody off the hook. You can't just let people off the hook because they were on a reality show, is what I'm saying. You know, I think that's what the judge said.
Of course. But you make a very good point because, you know, we have one judge in the Central District of Los Angeles, U.S. Federal Court. And this particular judge, who is really considered to be a hanging judge for large-scale narcotics trafficking cases and cases of that sort, but for fraud cases, for years, here's what he does. You know, say it's a garden variety fraud case. In fact, I have a client right now. It's a garden variety fraud case. What the heck did he, I'm blanking out. I don't know what he did, but it was, normal garden variety fraud. And he, well, I know it was, yeah, sure. But I don't want to give any particulars. But anyway, he has this particular judge, the famous Manuel L. Reed, who is probably been overturned on appeal more than any other judge, in certainly in U.S. Central District of California. But he invariably, for fraud cases, almost every time, as long as you plead guilty, accept responsibility, say, forgive me, Father, I have sinned, Judge Real will give you probation. It'll put you on probation for 5 years, and he will give you 2,000 to 3,000 hours of community service. 2,000 hours of community service, that's a 40-hour-a-week job for 50 weeks. And so he strongly feels that the proper way to do it, and these are, you know, I mean, this is not Bernie Maddox. He's a, you know, $1 million fraud, $2 million fraud. He believes the way to deal with this is to give people probation, make them do thousands of hours of community service. And then what he does is he has them come in to meet with him in chambers every 3 months for the entire time they're on probation. And so it's a pretty, you know, probably a pretty intelligent way to deal with, you know, these situations rather than just, you know, I mean, because, see, the other thing about people that commit fraud, you know, garden variety fraud, they really 95% of the time, they are not at all bad people. They're perfectly good people. Unfortunately, they've given in to the fatal flaw of a, you know, greed, which is probably the fatal flaw that people give into more than, you know, maybe anything else. And so, you know, so that's where they get in trouble. And so it's just, you know, one judge's way of dealing with this. Most other judges, those same guys that Judge Real, you know, most other judges would be giving those guys anywhere from, you know, 2 to 4 or 5 years in federal prison.
So do you try to, you can't really decide, I mean, you can't pick and choose your judges, but I guess you're relieved when you get this guy as the judge for your clients, because you're thinking they got a better chance of getting probation. But it's sort of, it's a lottery, right? The lottery system where you get who you get. You really can't, you can't request
exactly
a judge.
Exactly.
Well, it's fascinating. We've talked about this, I think, before on various occasions. I mean, just the fact that there is unequal justice, because I believe that you should have wisdom for individual judges if they exercise it, but sometimes you have crazy judges who give, like, you know, a rapist, if in certain jurisdictions, there was that case, I think, in Wisconsin for 30 days in the county jail, and people were outraged, and they went back and tried to get him repealed. So sometimes these judges go off the train, but on the other hand, with certain, like, the mandatory drug sentences, their hands are tied, the judges, where they just have to do it, and you're always saying, well, wisdom should prevail, and people should be able to see through that. I mean, it's like that case in, it was New Jersey, that woman who, well, it's still pending, I guess, but she was arrested. She had gotten a gun legally in Pennsylvania. You're familiar with this case? And she drove over the border, and she got stopped for a speeding ticket, told the trooper that she had a gun in the car. She was immediately arrested. She never used the gun. She had bought it because she was mugged or broken into, or her house was broken into. And she was arrested, and she's facing like 7 or 10 years in prison. This was the same DA who's prosecuting her, was the one who let Ray Rice off the hook with his assault charge against his then-fiancée, now wife. And that became under scrutiny, so now they're reevaluating it because CNN got a hold of it. And this is where the media can help and put the spotlight on how unfair this was. This woman was minding her own business. She didn't realize it's illegal to carry a gun in a car in New Jersey, crossed over the border, and she's in a jackpot with no criminal record and never even used a gun.
That does seem outrageous that she's facing that much time.
Yeah, well, they're reevaluating it,
and
maybe they'll get her off.
You're absolutely right. There is unequal justice in, you know, to different people in different situations. And there's also, there's the issue of, you know, state and local crimes versus federal crimes, which tend to be handled very differently. For example, my boss was just telling me the other day, typically in drug crimes, trafficking crimes, federal sentences are stiffer than state sentences. Yet in Illinois, from a trafficking standpoint, it's a relatively small amount of cocaine, a couple of kilos, which by, you know, trafficking standards is not a lot. Obviously it's a lot to the ordinary person. But, in federal court, for a couple kilos of cocaine, you might get anywhere from, you know, 2 to 4 years, something like that. Yet in the state of Illinois, this particular client is facing 15 years. And so, you know, just different laws are very different depending on the jurisdiction. And in the bottom line is, to me, it's like people just, you know, oh, man, you just got to be careful. And, of course, people are not careful. But then there's a certain hypocrisy to me because I make a living because people are not careful.
Well, there you go. Right.
And the prosecutors are, you know, and it's not just me. It's every prosecutor, every DA, every assistant U.S. attorney, in America is, you know, making a living because we have these laws and because people are not careful. If this wasn't the situation, I'd have,
I'd have an ordinary job. Yeah, you have to feed the beast. But that's also the argument against the privatizing of, you know, the prison, industrial prison complex, as they call it. You know, the idea that prisons are now private and it's a profit-making enterprise, so you want to have these longer prison sentences. But what a waste of life, especially. I mean, I believe the people that need to be locked away are the Charles Mansons, the Ariel Castros who took his own life. You know, the monsters, the people who are out there, predators. And very often you hear these stories of people like that guy, I can't think of his name, who kidnapped that poor woman in Virginia, who was crazy.
Right, sure.
He got out, you know, he beat up his wife, and he got a very minor sentence because domestic violence is not treated as seriously as it should be. So a lot of times these people seem to get out early who are rapists and molesters, people who are true predators, and they wind up doing it again, where you're sticking these minor league drug criminals who really probably are junkies most of the time, so they're only hurting themselves. In many cases, don't even give them rehab, and, you know, warehouse them for years and years, sometimes decades of their lives, which I think is unconscionable. So there really are some serious injustices, but you're not really protecting the public because you're letting these rapists get out early, and they wind up committing more crimes. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. It's mind-boggling, but, you know,
right.
we've been on the soapbox before.
It's a good point. It's a good point because, you know, despite rumors to the contrary, no one forces anyone to take that, you know, first hit, that first fix.
Right.
People use drugs willingly and because they want to get high. And so in a sense, it's, you know, it's very much drug crime is a victimless crime as opposed to violent crime and sex crimes. And that's actually been an eye-opener to me running the crime blog because in our practice, we're handling mostly fraud and drug trafficking crimes. The 90% of federal cases are fraud and drug trafficking. And so the whole world of violent crime, I was pretty innocent. I was, you know, to some degree, I hadn't been exposed to it much till I started I'm doing all things crime blog. And I've really been, you know, it's been an eye-opener to me. I've been shocked by, you know, just the nature, the heinous nature of, you know, a lot of these,
you probably don't,
violent crimes and sex crimes.
Yeah, you probably don't want those guys or gals to be your clients because they're probably scarier. They probably do score very off the charts in the psychopath scale. But let's talk about a good segue for your book, which is kind of a thriller that takes on crime called Cicero's Dead. Talk a little bit about, I haven't had the chance to read it yet, so I don't know much about it, but give me the setup about what it's about and what inspired it.
Yeah, well, okay, I can. What inspired it was I'd always been interested in writing, and I'd written a few books back in my early 30s, and I had a good established East Coast agent, tried to get a couple of them published, didn't succeed. They, died on the vine. And so I went on with life, did this and that, played rock and roll for quite a few years, and ended up down in the way I came to Los Angeles to work in criminal defense is when it would have been about 14 years now. I got an idea, and I wrote a menage a trois kind of not like a romance, like, a romance for the romance market, but more like it's a serious book, but it kind of segued into, it had elements of the thriller and in the second half, and it was fun. It was well written, but it probably had, no commercial potential whatsoever. Anyway, I sent that down to my boss in Los Angeles, and he read it, and he realized that I was a good writer. And so at that point, he invited me to come down and join the company. So we moved the family to L.A., and I joined the company. I'm on my 12th year now. I'll be there for probably another 5 years or so till I'll be able to finally sayonara to the world of crime, at least at least working in it. And so anyway, working for him, I learned a great deal about the world of crime. And long about that time, I happened to see the movie Mystic River, which is based on a novel by Dennis Lehane.
I'm sure
you've probably seen Mystic River. And I thought, wow, this is a very, very good movie. And then I read the book. I thought, wow, this is a very good book. And then I discovered that Dennis Lehane had written a series of PI novels with his investigators, Patrick Kinsey, and his girlfriend, Angelo Gennaro. And I read the series, with the exception I didn't read the first one, which was called A Drink Before the War, which I've never read. And so I read them, and I thought they were very good. They were, really quite high quality, but they were definitely, like genre fiction of very high quality. And so I started thinking, I thought, well, maybe I can do this. This would be kind of fun to do, because I still, I still had the itch to write. And so I set to work about 6 years ago on writing what is now just recently been published. By the way, I want to put in a good word for my publisher, U.S. Indie Books. That's www.usindiebooks.com. The man running it, Max Myers, has been a pretty successful, over the years, Los Angeles screenwriter who has segued into crime fiction later in life. And I think the world of Max, and I think he... if anyone is to go to www.usindiebooks.com, he has just a tremendous website. I'm not an expert on websites, but I think he's done a great job. And he's just published three books, one of which is my book, Cicero's Dead. So anyway, I began writing Cicero, and I didn't have the slightest idea what I was doing. But I came up with some characters. I've always been, pretty decent at, characters and not bad at dialogue. And so, I came up with characters and dialogue, and then I had to, I had to come up with a storyline, which was the challenging part. And so the story is basically about, it's about my investigator, Nick Crane, who's a private investigator in Los Angeles. He's contacted by a beautiful young woman named Jade Lamont. Jade is an heiress who's basically sitting on, she and her brother Richard are sitting on $300 million. Now, the story begins. Nick goes to her condominium. It's actually one of the Donald Sterling condos on, Wilshire out in West Los Angeles. And he goes there and he meets her. And he discovers, three very, strange things have happened to Jade. Number one, her father, Cicero, is dead. Or he's reportedly dead. He's apparently been killed in a hit-and-run accident. Number two, her mother, who had separated from Cicero just a few weeks before Cicero was killed, she moved up to San Francisco and she committed suicide. And then Jade's only sibling, her brother Richard, who she's very close to, has vanished. And so Nick Crane gets hired to find Richard, but also he's obsessed with, well, what happened to Cicero, and what happened to Jade and Richard's mother. So the story basically consists of him attempting to solve these three mysteries.
Don't give too much away. Just give people. Y'all give a teaser. You don't want to give. Don't tell the whole story, because then nobody will buy the book.
Right,
you gave
exactly,
us enough just to get tantalized.
Yeah.
You got to work on the teaser line, just so we don't give away too much. But it sounds fascinating, and what a journey! And as you know, so many of my clients and listeners, think things happen sometimes overnight. It doesn't. You have to work at it and put in your time, and you obviously have done that. So congratulations to get to the finish line with an actual published book.
I found that one of the interesting things is from when you manage to write a first draft of a novel. My first draft was about 170,000 words, 120,000 mm-hmm. words. I cut it later on to 90,000 words. Then my editor got a hold of it. And lo and behold, at this point, it's a lean, mean 73,000 words, 266 pages in a trade paperback, create-on-demand form. So that process of taking, an early version of a book and refining it and perfecting it, to the best of your ability, that's a fascinating process. And in many ways, it's probably harder than actually, writing a first draft of a novel.
The old adage is writing is rewriting, and because that's where you shape it. But the first part is the fun part, the first draft, because you let yourself go. That's what I always tell people. Just have fun with it and, battle back the inner critic, which sometimes keeps tagging along, saying, oh, this isn't good. But just keep pushing through, do it, let it all out, and then you can go back and take out stuff and put in stuff and restructure it if you need to. But you will need to. Nothing like, slapping
in
together.
In your novels, Amy Beth, do you kind of... like just let yourself go when you write your first draft, and then
pretty much
begin the rewrite.
I let it go and I shape it along the way. If I see something, like right now I'm in the process of doing my third one, and I just realize something that I have to, early on that I want to add to it. So sometimes something will come up and say, oh, wait a minute, this really needs to happen first. So that happens as it goes. But I try to let the story go where it's going to go. I try to allow the characters to take me on their journey as much as possible. It is a murder mystery, and just like you're doing a thriller, the same kind of thing, you have to have a plot there, so you do have plot points, and I have to plant clues, so that's a little more, there's a little bit of a slight outline involved. I'm not a rigorous, mm-hmm. they say, are you a plotter or a panster, writing on the seat of your pants. I'm by nature more of a panster, but with a mystery, you kind of have to plant those clues, so you do have to kind of figure out what's what. But things do change, and sometimes revelations happen. I mean, in the first book, I thought I knew the murderer wasn't. It was a different person by the end, so I had to then go back to make sure that the clues all fit and worked out. So my advice to anybody is just go with it at first and let the story take you where it wants to take you, and that's the most organic writing. If you're too constrained and you pretty much have everything figured out before you write it, it's not going to be as good, I don't think.
It's too formulaic. I did want to say one final thing about Cicero's Dead. We've been pleased as at this point. We have all of the reviews we've got so far. We have all five-star reviews, five-star readers' reviews, and we're contracted with the Reader's Favorite organization. And so we have two five-star editorial reviews. So we're pretty pleased because the initial response has been very positive. And so at this point, we just have to sell hundreds of thousands of books, or at least that's the goal. We'll see what happens.
Keep going. You're going to do another one? Is it going to be a series, or is this a standalone?
Yeah, I think a series. The second one is basically finished, other than the more final revision processes. I recently cut it from 120,000 words to 90,000 words, and now I have to add a few sections, but it will be ready for the deep editorial process before long.
Right.
So I think U.S. Indie Books plans on probably publishing it, late spring or early next summer. But we'll see. That remains to be seen.
All right. Well, keep on going. Enjoy it. And congratulations. I appreciate it. Hey, Patrick Moore, always a pleasure. Time flies when we chat. Appreciate your takes on all these interesting justice stories. I'm sure we'll have you back again. And if people want to find out about the book, what's the best place to go? Do you have a website for it, or what's the best?
Well, it's on www.usindiebooks.com, so they can access it there. or they can access it on All Things Crime blog. It's on the sign on the sidebar. There's a picture of the book cover. Cicero's Dead. Click on that. Takes you immediately to Amazon, where you can where you can buy the book, or you know, or read the teaser and see if you're interested.
Yeah.
Or the other way, just type in Amazon Cicero's Dead, and you'll go right there.
And it's available for paperback and ebook, both paperback and ebook.
Yes. Yes, it's paper. Yeah, it's a handsome trade paperback version. I think my my publisher Max Myers did a tremendous job of coming up with the idea for a great cover. So I'm really pleased about that. And so,
all right,
you sound enthusiastic. Yeah,
we'll put the link up too on Twitter and Facebook. Patrick Moore, thanks for joining us. Congratulations on the book Cicero's Dead. Find out more at the All Things Crime blog. And at Amazon, we'll talk to you again, I'm sure. Take care now.
Okay, thanks so much, Amy Beth. I had a great time. See you.
Always a pleasure. Take care. All right, reach out. We still have a little time left. Always fun. Time flies when we're talking with Patrick Moore. Give us a call, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed, too, at Amy Writes. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show.
got heavy when we got to the bathroom. We didn't go back to her place. We went someplace where she can't sit. She said, I know I look tired, but everything's fried here in Memphis. Bathroom, too, doesn't make any difference. It can't be important. We asked her to tell the story again. In barlight, she looks alright. In daylight, she looks desperate. Let her out of desperate, too. I'm getting pretty sick of this interview. It might be a rental. I remember she had satellite radio. I guess she seemed a bit nervous. Do you think I'm that stupid? Well, what the hell, tell the story again. In barlight, she looks alright. In daylight, she was desperate. That Colorado is desperate too. I'm getting pretty sick of this interview.
Justice Junkie Patrick Moore on the Amy Beth Arkowy Show, also the late great Warren Zevon, and Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Thanks again, Patrick. Always interesting insights, and congrats on the new book. Find out more about his debut thriller, Cicero's Dead, at the All Things Crime blog or at usindiebooks.com or just Amazon. You can put in the title of the book or Patrick Moore, and you'll find it. So, hey, speaking of interesting things, don't forget this Friday, it's the Grateful Bounty, the second annual cornucopia of great music, your requests and dedications featured in the mix. We've got a slew of them. You got good taste. I got good taste. What could go wrong? But we still have a couple of slots left, possibly. Trudy said she'll give you till the end of today, so do so ASAP if you want to get in to this year's delicious cornucopia by doing it at the Twitter feed at AB Writes, hashtag Grateful Bounty, or the website amybetharkowy.com. The show will air live this coming Friday, November 21st, thereafter for podcasts for Thanksgiving and the holiday season. Lots of fun. Next week, a little holiday week, we'll revisit our conversation on Tuesday with fellow mystery author Nancy Rathbun, who has just released the latest in her Angelo Bonaparte series called Cash Kills. And we also have a send-up to poetry in that episode. And then on Friday, I'm taking last year's leftovers from the Grateful Bounty out of the deep freeze. It's the Grateful Bounty Port de Rida, and they're just as good as ever, if not better, after a year. So get ready for a lot of fun as we take a little bit of a holiday break. But we're back in December with some great shows, including our Jolly Holidays show, and we'll also get you in the mix. If you want to be a guest in the show, by the way, maybe a slot or two available for December, and then we're wide open for 2015. Always looking for compelling storytellers of all types, from authors to filmmakers, musicians to theater folks, social crusaders, media mavens, justice junkies, and personal growth experts. Hop over to the website, amybetharkowy.com, and we'll try to get you on the show, that has been awarded a Top Professional Podcast Award from Mediabytes, who dubs us an empowering, entertaining tour de force. No argument from me. No. So we started to talk about writing and what inspires you the most. Is it good writing or is it flat-out bad writing? I think they both can work. Sometimes reading something that's so great, you read a masterpiece, and it's kind of daunting, like The Hours, or any time I get my hands on a Ellen Gilchrist collection, I'm like, oh, geez, I'm never going to write that well. But it kind of inspires you to try. And sometimes you read a book that's not that great, and you're like, hey, I can do better than that. So I recommend reading all types of things. Try to, you know, genre jump a little bit and try different things on for size and see what works for you and what strikes you, and then just go for it and embrace those dreams. If you want to write, just do it. And as Patrick said, you know, he tried his hand. He has a couple of books, like we all do, knocking around the file cabinet somewhere. And just keep plugging away and keep doing it, and it could help you get there. The Inspiration to Action Challenge has helped some folks. Today I want to give a quick shout-out to Marcy, who is in the Boston area working on poetry and sculpture. She says, I'm listening to my muse and doing what I need to do, and the challenge helped me get back in touch with my inner artist. So I thank you very much for helping me on this journey. Well, thank you very much, Marcy. I'm glad it's working for you. If it's working for you, I'd love to give you a shout-out. And I'm also happy to help you get cajoled in that right direction with a creativity coaching and or counseling conversation. First one always on me. Hop over to the website, amybetharkawi.com. That's also a place to delve into the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series. Both Killing Time and Dead Silent are available for ebook and paperback. And I am indeed cooking on number 3. Took a back burner for a while. Now I'm into it because I let those characters take their time. They're telling me where to go, and I'm going. So we'll see what happens. I hope it's going to be good. I think it will. Trudy's giving me those hairy eyeballs again. Here we go. We had a mystery author on. We have to roll out the classic. Jerry Lewis, Love or Murder Mystery. I'm Amy Beth Arkawisha.
I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. The heroine is yelling while the sponsor goes on selling.
Don't touch me, you brute!
Use delirium for your tube.
Sam shovels in the hovel, he must grovel for a clue. I love it, I love it, I really, really do.
Charlotte comes to give his arms, interrupted by the sponsor.
You see Watson, when the villain.
Painless Joe will do your drilling. I'm nervous when I turn the dial, I'm dizzy in the head. When it's time for in the stankum, I go underneath my bed.
Don't shoot me, Biggs the Stoolie, as they put him through the mill.
I'll shoot you, I'll shoot you. Seriously, I will. The girl he tries to take, and then we have a station break.
Come on, baby, come to me. Boing, boing, boing. This is station COD.
He's not breathing. But how can he? He's dead. He's dead? Why, this is a job for Superman, or Hopper Longevity, or Jack Headstrong, the All-American Boy, or Jerry Lewis. But I don't scare easily, not me. I'm too frightened to be scared. I'll find the killer. I'll search the apartment. Aha! Just as I thought. 3 shoes under the bed. Well, that's logical for a man with 3 feet.
But I have it now, Inspector. I can name your killer for you. His name is...
Painless Joe will do your drilling. My flesh begins to creep, and then my skin begins to crawl. You think I was a worm the way I wiggled down the hall. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. I love it when I'm listening late at night, and a murderer is stalking a heroine. And a hero is stalking a murderer, and a private eye is stalking a hero. And a cop is stalking a private eye. And they're coming in closer and closer, surely but closer and surely. They're coming out of the radio. Now they're stalking me. What have I done? I was only listening to the radio. Now they're throwing toothpaste at me. They're coming closer and closer. And I don't know the conjunctive moves of anyone that may be based on the fact that other people say the same their facts. Where else are the Crendor? And certainly not the one in Rio. I'm not going up to know that anyone else may say I'm wrong. And I feel that I must stay here now. No one else will ever know the facts. I wish I was dead.
Roll pulled it out. The Jerry Lewis classic, I Love a Murder Mystery, up on the radio. Every time we have a murder mystery, Arthur, on, she has to do it. The Amy Beth Arkley Show, thanks so much for joining us on the Twitter feed. Getting busy today. Like It Like That, one of our hearty regulars, Johnny Fever's Hangover, checking in. Another great interview, AB. We'll check out the rest of the show on podcast. All right, you do that. And don't forget the shows are all archived for podcast. Follow the Amy Beth Arkley Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. You can download episodes there. Also available on NetNow and iTunes and at our website, amybetharkley.com. Tanya checking in. Ferguson is going to be a bad deal. I'm afraid media should have stayed out of it. Yeah, some stuff that we were talking about with Patrick Moore earlier. We'll see what happens. We're braced for that grand jury verdict. I still think they should have put it out and just had the indictment, let him go to trial, and just see how it plays out, because people dig their heels in on these narratives all the time, and I don't really know either what the truth is, but I think it should be played out in transparency so people can see it. That's just my take on it. But we'll see when we find out about it. I'm sure we'll be talking about it. Hallie says, great show. I'm going to check out the book. Like you guys together. You sound great. All right. Simpatico. We're working on it. We've had Patrick on before. He's always a fan fave. Always appreciate it when people chime in with us on in real time, and you can still do so. A few minutes left here. Not too much time, though. We talked for a while. We gabbed and gabbed and gabbed. Good stuff, though. At the Twitter feed at AB Writes and the phone line 347-857-4505. So the Grateful Bounty is coming up, and we have some good ones, some great songs to share. We'll share our thoughts and what we're thankful for the year, as well as the infamous Thanksgiving Day dish wish list. What are you looking forward to eating or making or cooking, and where you go in this holiday weekend? I hope the weather holds. Apparently, we're going to have a slight warm-up nationwide, I think, next week, so maybe that won't be some travel issues. But it's very cold. A lot of people in the deep freeze today, so please be careful and bundle up. I mean, there were places that are not used to so much cold, like down south New Orleans had was below freezing this morning. So Buffalo got a bunch of snow. Some snow in the Midwest, so please be careful. It's too early for this, even for the hardy folks like in Minnesota. It's kind of early for this kind of nonsense, I think. But hopefully you won't have a bad day. You'll have a good day. That's the hope here, for sure. So reach out again if you want to be on the Grateful Bounty. Do so today. Get your songs, dedications in via Twitter at AB Writes, hashtag Grateful Bounty, or the website amybetharkley.com. Thanks again, Patrick Moore. Sister is Dead is his debut novel. Find out more about it at All Things Crime blog or at usindiebooks.com or, of course, trusty Amazon. Way to go. Congratulations again on that, Patrick. Good stuff. I hope you have yourself a great week. Whatever you do, wherever you go, drive safe, play nice, dream big, and, hey, come on back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. You can friend me on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at AB Writes. Thank you, Trudy. Thank you, Aurora. Thank you, ML, at TCS headquarters. Get back to writing that book. Every darn day. Take care.
I can remember like it was only yesterday. Love was young and foolish, like a little child at play. But oh, how lovers change. I never dreamed out easily. For now, I'm just the shadow of the boy I used. Oh, yeah, yeah. And when I write the book about my
End of story. Or is it?
Right.